And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today's May 21st, 141st day of the year. 224 days remain till the year's over with. On this day in history, in the year 293, Roman Emperors Diocletian and Maximian appoint Galerius as Caesar to Diocletian, beginning the period of four rulers known as the Tetrarchy. 878, Syracuse, Sicily is captured by the Muslim Aglubids after a 9-month siege. 879, Pope John VIII gives blessings to Branimir of Croatia to the Croatian people, considered to be international recognition of the Croatian state. 996, 16-year-old Otto III is crowned Holy Roman Emperor. You know, our ancestor did some truly stupid things, a 16-year-old being the Holy Roman Emperor. 1349, Dusan's Code, the Constitution of the Serbian Empire, is enacted by Dusan the Mighty. 1403, Henry III of Castile sends Ruy Gonzalez de Clavijo as ambassador to Timur to discuss the possibility of an alliance between Timur and Castile against the Ottoman Empire. 1554, Queen Mary I grants a royal charter to Derby School, a grammar school for boys in Derby, England. 1659, in the concert of The Hague, the Dutch Republic, the Commonwealth of England, and the Kingdom of France set out their views on how the Second Northern War should end. 1660, the Battle of Long Sault concludes after 5 days in which the French colonial militia, with their Huron and Algonquin allies, are defeated by the Iroquois Confederacy. 1674, the nobility elect John Sobieski, King of Poland and Grand Duke of Lithuania. 1703, Daniel Defoe, who wrote Robinson Crusoe, was imprisoned on charges of seditious libel. 1725, the Order of St. Alexander Nevsky is instituted in Russia by Empress Catherine I. It would later be discontinued and reinstated by the Soviet government in 1942 as the Order of Alexander Nevsky. 1758, 10-year-old Mary Campbell is abducted in Pennsylvania by Lenape during the French and Indian War. She's returned 6.5 years later. A little bit the worse for wear, but she was returned. 1792, a lava dome collapses on Mount Unzen near the city of Simbaran on the Japanese island of Kyushu, creating a deadly tsunami that killed almost 15,000 people. 1809, the first day of the Battle of Aspern Essling between the Austrian army led by Archduke Charles and the French army led by Napoleon I of France sees the French attack across the Danube held. 1851, slavery in Colombia is abolished. 1856, Lawrence, Kansas is captured and burned by pro-slavery forces. 1863, American Civil War. Union Army succeeds in closing off the last escape route from Port Hudson, Louisiana in preparation for the coming siege. 1864, Russia declares the end of the Russo-Circassian War, and a lot of Circassians are forced into exile. That day is designated as Circassian Day of Mourning. 1864, American Civil War. On this date, the Battle of Spotsylvania Courthouse ends. Also in 1864, the Ionian Islands reunite with Greece. 1871, French troops invade the Paris Commune and engage its residents in street fighting. By the close of Bloody Week, some 20,000 communards have been killed and 38,000 arrested. 1871, opening of the first rack railway in Europe, the Rigi-Bannon on Mount Rigi. 1879, War of the Pacific. Two Chilean ships blocking the harbor of Iquique, then belonging to Peru, battle two Peruvian vessels in the Battle of Iquique. 1881, the American Red Cross is established by Clara Barton in Washington, D.C. 1894, the Manchester Ship Canal in the UK is officially opened by Queen Victoria. She later knights the designer, Sir Edward Leader Williams. 1904, the Federation Internationale de Football Association, or FIFA, is founded in Paris. 1911, President of Mexico, Porfirio Diaz, and the revolutionary Francisco Madero signed the Treaty of Ciudad Juarez to put an end to the fighting between the forces of both men. Concludes the initial phase of the Mexican Revolution. 1917, the Imperial War Graves Commission is established through a royal charter to mark, record, maintain the graves and places of commemoration of the British Empire's military forces. 1917, the Great Atlanta Fire of 1917 caused 5.5 million in damages, destroyed over 300 acres, including 2,000 homes, businesses, and churches, displaced about 10,000 people. But there was only one fatality, and that happened due to a heart attack. 1924, University of Chicago student Richard Leib and Nathan Leopold Jr. murdered 14-year-old Bobby Francis in what was known as a thrill killing. They wanted to know how it felt to kill somebody. 1927, Charles Lindbergh touches down at Le Bourget Field in Paris, completing the world's first solo nonstop flight across the Atlantic Ocean. 1932, bad weather forces Amelia Earhart to land in a pasture in Derry, Northern Ireland, and she becomes the first female to fly solo across the Atlantic Ocean. 1934, Oskaloosa, Iowa becomes the first municipality in the U.S. to fingerprint all of its citizens. 1936, Sada Abe is arrested for after wandering the streets of Tokyo for days with her dead lover's severed genitals in her handbag. Her story becomes one of Japan's most notorious scandals. 1937, Soviet station North Pole 1 becomes the first scientific settlement to operate on the drift ice of the Atlantic Ocean. 1939, the Canadian National War Memorial is unveiled by King George VI and Queen Elizabeth in Ottawa, Ontario, Canada. 1946, physicist Louis Slotin is fatally irradiated in a critical incident during an experiment with the Demon Core at Los Alamos National Laboratory. Now, the Demon Core was a spherical, subcritical mass of plutonium, about 3.5 inches in diameter, manufactured during World War II by the U.S. Nuclear Weapon Development Effort, the Manhattan Project. It's going to be official core for an early atomic bomb. Unfortunately, it was involved in two critical accidents, August 21st, 1945, and May 21st, 1946. It was intended for use as a possible third nuclear weapon to be dropped on Japan, but when Japan surrendered, it was used for testing. It was designed with a small safety margin to ensure a successful explosion of the bomb. And the device briefly went supercritical when it was accidentally put in a supercritical configuration during two separate experiments. You know, the bottom line is we were playing with things we didn't know what we were doing, and people died. 1951, opening of the Knight Street Show, otherwise known as the Knight Street Art Exhibit. Gathering of a number of notable artists and the stepping out of the post-war New York avant-garde. It was collectively known as the New York School. 1961, American Civil Rights Movement. Alabama Governor John Malcolm Patterson declares martial law in an attempt to restore order after a number of race riots break out. 1966, the Ulster Volunteer Force declares war on the Irish Republican Army in Northern Ireland. 1969, civil unrest in Rosario, Argentina, known as Rosario Azo, following the death of a 15-year-old student. 1972, Michelangelo's Pietà in St. Peter's Basilica in Rome is damaged by a vandal. It was the mentally disturbed Hungarian geologist Laszlo Toth. 1976, 29 people are killed in the Yuba City bus disaster in Martinez, California. 1979, White Night riots in San Francisco following the manslaughter conviction of Dan White for the assassination of George Moscone and Harvey Milk. He wanted to be appointed to a government job and didn't get it, so he went on a shooting rampage. 1981, the Italian government releases the membership list of Propaganda Due, an illegal pseudo-Masonic lodge that was implicated in numerous Italian crimes and mysteries. 1981, Transamerica Corporation agrees to sell United Artists to Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer for $380 million after the box office failure of the 1980 film Heaven's Gate. 1982, Falklands War, a British amphibious assault during Operation Sutton, leads to the Battle of San Carlos. 1991, former Indian Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi is assassinated by a female suicide bomber near Madras. 1991, Mengistu Haile Mariam, President of the People's Democratic Republic of Ethiopia, flees Ethiopia, effectively bringing the Ethiopian Civil War to an end. 1992, after 30 seasons, Johnny Carson hosted his penultimate episode and last featured guest, which were Robin Williams and Bette Midler on The Tonight Show. 1994, the Democratic Republic of Yemen unsuccessfully attempts to secede from the Republic of Yemen. War breaks out. 1996, the ferry MV Bukoba sinks in the Tanzanian waters of Lake Victoria. Nearly 1,000 people die. 1998, in Miami, 5 abortion clinics are attacked by a butyric acid attacker. Also in 1998, President Suharto of Indonesia resigns following the killing of students from the Trisakti University earlier that week by security forces and the growing mass protest in Jakarta against his ongoing corrupt rule. 2001, French Tobira laws enacted, officially recognizing the Atlantic slave trade and slavery as crimes against humanity. 2003, the 6.8 Boumerdes earthquake shakes northern Algeria with a maximum Mercalli intensity of 10, which is considered extreme. More than 2,200 people are killed, and a moderate tsunami sinks boats in the Balearic Islands. 2005, the tallest roller coaster in the world, King Daka, opens at Six Flags Great Adventure in Jackson Township in New Jersey. 2006, Republic of Montenegro holds a referendum proposing independence from the state union of Serbia and Montenegro. 55% of Montenegrins vote for independence. 2010, JAXA, the Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency, launches the solar sail spacecraft Icarus aboard a H-11A rocket. Alrighty, 2011 radio broadcaster Harold Camping predicted that the world would end on this date in 2011. 2012, a bus accident near Himera, Albania kills 13 and injures 21. 2012, a suicide bombing kills more than 120 people in Sana'a, Yemen. And in 2017, Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey Circus performs their final show at Nassau Veterans Memorial Coliseum. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays and observances. Afro-Colombian Day in Colombia. Christian Feast Day. Arcangelo Tadini. Blessed Adilo Daronche and Manuel Gomez Gonzalez. Blessed Franz Jagerstatter. Earliest day in which Corpus Christi can fall, June 24th is the latest. It's held on Thursday after Trinity Sunday in the Roman Catholic Church. Emperor Constantine I, Eugene de Mazenod, Helena de Constantinople, also known as Feast of the Holy Great Sovereigns Constantine and Helen, equal to the Apostles, in the Eastern Orthodox Church and Anglican Communion. John Elliott in the Episcopal Church, saints of the Cristero War, including Christopher Magallanes, Circassian Day of Mourning, and Circassians, Day of Patriots and Military in Hungary, Independence Day celebrates the Montenegrin Independence Referendum of 2006 in Montenegro, International Tea Day internationally, Navy Day in Chile, St. Helena Day celebrates the discovery of St. Helena in 1502. That's celebrated in St. Helena, Ascension, and Tristan da Cunha. And World Day for Cultural Diversity for Dialogue and Development internationally, which makes very little sense as far as I'm concerned. All right, let's see what else we might have. In 878, Syracuse is captured by the Muslim Sultan of Sicily. In 996, Pope Gregory V crowns his cousin Otto III as Holy Roman Emperor in St. Peter's Basilica in Rome. In 1216, the French crown prince Louis enters England. He was invited by the barons at war with King John. In 1260, Hui Hing, envoy of Mongol leader Kublai Khan, imprisoned by order of the High Chancellor of China, Zhao Sideo, at the Song Dynasty court of Emperor Luzong, while attempting to negotiate with the Song Dynasty. Kublai Khan was not exactly happy about that. 1281, Kublai Khan's second invasion of Japan begins with an attack on Tsushima Island but meets fierce resistance. Eventually, his forces are forced to withdraw. 1382, earthquake is centered on Dover Straits with an estimated magnitude of 6.0, causes widespread damage, including damage to Canterbury Cathedral. 1420, the Treaty of Troyes specified that Henry V of England and his heirs would inherit the throne of France upon the death of King Charles VI of France. 1471, King Edward IV enters London. 1499, Francisco de Bobadilla, appointed governor of the Indies. He succeeded Christopher Columbus. 1602, Martha's Vineyard is first sighted by Captain Bartholomew Gosnold. 1683, the West Indian Company sells one-third of Suriname. 1793, Curacao Island Council forbids criticism of the House of Orange. You criticize, you die. 1809, Battle of Aspern-Essling, Austrian Archduke Charles beats Napoleon and his army. That was Napoleon's first defeat in 10 years. 1819, the first bicycles, which were known as Swift Walkers, were introduced into New York City on this date. 1832, the first U.S. Democratic National Convention is held in Baltimore. 1840, Captain William Hobson proclaims British sovereignty over New Zealand, the North Island by treaty, and the South Island by discovery. 1846, the first steamship arrives in Hawaii. 1861, Richmond, Virginia is designated to be the Confederate capital. 1864, General David Hunter takes command of the Department of West Virginia. 1881, the U.S. National Lawn Tennis Association is established in New York City. And finally, in 1904, France recalls its ambassador to the Vatican to protest the Pope's attempt to discipline two French bishops. This is another incident that drove France and the Catholic Church apart. And on those interesting notes, we're going to go back and talk about military encounters with extraterrestrials. Yesterday, we started talking about the Battle of Los Angeles, which was, according to the military, it was just war nerves. According to people on the ground, there were aircraft flying over the city. And the 14th Fighter Squadron was officially told to stand down. Nobody's ever admitted that military aircraft engaged whatever these things were. Now, in any case, it's come out that the federal government authorities lied about the Battle of Los Angeles from the beginning. Neither the account of witnesses nor that of any other witness to the event of February 25th described seeing weather balloons, meteorological phenomena, or even aircraft, ours or theirs or anybody else's. Now, it makes you wonder why the government would go to such lengths to lie. Now, a number of other witnesses reported seeing flares coming out of the sky. None were dropped or shot heavenward by the California Defenders, according to Dirk van der Ploeg. Observers reported lighted objects, so variously described as red and white flares, in groups of three red and three white, fired alternatively or chain-like strings of red lights. It was kind of like an illuminated kite was one of the best descriptions. Now, most descriptions of the Battle of Los Angeles overlooked the fact that the metropolitan area had been put on alert at 7:18 p.m. February 24th, the night before the shooting started. And the blackout was imposed when air raid wardens reported strange blinking lights and flares in the sky near the city's defense plants. Now, the presence of such unaccountable objects in the immediate vicinity of the weapons-producing infrastructure was reminiscent of similar encounters at the DuPont munitions factories in 1916. It also foreshadowed their reappearance over atomic bomb facilities from the close of World War II until, frankly, to the present. Many sightings from numerous civilian, military, and professional observers were at odds with official explanations of weather balloons, meteorological conditions, or just plain old war nerves. An angry editorial on the front page of the L.A. Times took such unconvincing interpretations to task. According to the Associated Press, Secretary Knox intimated reports of enemy activity in the Pacific coastal region might be due largely to jittery nerves. And the newspaper asked, whose nerves were they? Perhaps Mr. Knox, the public, maybe the Army. Seems to the Times that more specific public information ought to be forthcoming from government sources on the subject, if only to clarify their own conflicting statements. Other Southern California newspapers are similarly confused. Long Beach Independent said there's a mysterious reticence about the whole affair, and it appears that some form of censorship is trying to halt discussion of the matter. And although it was red-hot news, not a single national radio commentator gave it more than a passing mention. It's the kind of reticence that makes the American people gravely suspect the motives and competence of those whom they have charged with the conduct of the war. And certainly that was a major consideration. Even the staid New York Times expressed a belief that the more the incident was studied, the more incredible it became. In a February 28th editorial, the paper won all, as Secretary Knox implies. If that's the case, it's a sign of expensive incompetence and jitters. If the batteries were firing on real planes, some of them as low as 9,000 feet, according to Secretary Stimson, why were they completely ineffective?
and why, most importantly, did no American planes go up to engage them, or even to try to identify them? Prompted by the gathering controversy to call for a congressional investigation of the Battle of Los Angeles, Representative Leland Ford of Santa Monica declared, "None of the explanations so far offered remove the episode from the category of complete mystification. This was either a practice raid or a raid to throw a scare into 2 million people, or a mistaken identity raid, or a raid to lay a political foundation, take away Southern California's war industries. In any case, he couldn't accept federal public relations attempts at explaining away the event as a false alert. Clearly, there was something there." Later that same day, the LA Times published a large photograph taken by one of its own reporters during the height of the battle. Yeah, searchlights converged on and illuminated something entirely unlike any warplane known in the world at that time. It was at 9,000 feet, had no wings, tail, fuselage, or propeller. It resembled a bowl topped by another one, or an inverted dish joined at their rims, surmounted by an upside-down cup with flak bursting harmless around the object. Newspaper caption read, "Seeking out object." An object, not an aircraft or balloon, became the caption because the caption writer couldn't identify it. Scores of searchlights built a wigwam of light beams over Los Angeles early yesterday morning during the alarm, according to the article. This picture was taken during blackouts. Shows 9 beams converging on an object in the sky in Culver City. Blobs of light that show an apex of beam angles were made by anti-aircraft shells. According to Rents, the object was clearly locked in the focus of dozens of searchlights for well over half an hour and seen by hundreds of thousands of people. But somebody who was across the country explained it away by just calling it war nerves. It resembles nothing if not a stereotypical vehicle that, starting years after the war, was associated with extraterrestrial visitations. When the image was taken, no one so much as considered a non-earthly identity for the sighting. Since been seized upon by ufologists as photographic proof of a flying saucer from outer space. According to what's been written in Wikipedia, some ufologists and conspiracy theorists assert the photo was heavily modified by photo retouching prior to publication. But that was a routine practice in graphic arts at the time, intended to improve contrast in black and white photos. But what is not explained is why a newspaper graphic artist in early 1942, other than trying to improve contrast in a black-and-white shot, should have modified it by photo retouching so as to depict a characteristic UFO in an era when such things were just not known to the vast majority of American people. According to Bruce Maccabee, who tried to answer that question, he obtained a print made directly from the original and retouched negative to the L.A. Times, which is photographed for close analysis. Maccabee worked on optical data processing, generation of underwater sound with lasers and various aspects of the Strategic Defense Initiative, and the ballistic missile defense using high-powered lasers. As such, he was eminently qualified to assess the controversial image, and according to Bruce Maccabee, the fact that the beams of the spotlight appear in the photo basically don't get past the object. I mean, there is some faint evidence of beams above the object. Whatever it was in the beam convergence must have been optically quite dense. The beams are quite bright before they reach the object and zero, nearly zero afterwards. Now, just how much optical density of smoke this requires is unknown. Certainly a solid metallic object would be sufficient to block the beams. So how large is the object? Based on the width of the illuminated object, is on the order of 100 feet or more in size. Stephen Lacey, another photo analyst, was able to clear up the image into something that clearly shows a classic saucer-shaped craft right in the center of where all those searchlights are aimed. He said he enlarged the picture and adjusted the brightness and contrast using the levels tool. And the end result was a picture that clearly shows a saucer-shaped craft. Elsewhere in General George C. Marshall's statement that we mentioned earlier, he said how it was learned by Army G-2 that Rear Admiral Anderson recovered an unidentified plane off the coast of California with no bearing on conventional explanation. Your admiral he mentioned was Walter Stratton Anderson, died in 1981. He was indeed the senior commander of the U.S. Navy operations in the waters off Southern California during the Battle of Los Angeles. Littleton, later an anthropology professor at California's Occidental College, told of popular speculation during the days that followed. The rumor is that the unidentified plane that Marshall mentioned finally crashed in the waters recovered by Navy divers. So maybe it was damaged and crashed. If that's the case, then the U.S. government obtained its second off-world vehicle in less than a year. As a retired anthropology professor, Littleton admitted the object he and his parents saw in 1942 to the same scientific rigor used when teaching his students. He said, by process of elimination, the most efficient, and he says this as a scholar, he said, the most efficient explanation is that it was what we would call today a UFO, something not of this world, something that belonged to another technology. If that's true, then this event was one of the largest UFO sightings in history. Over 1 million people watched it cruise slowly up the coast. Well, while the West Coast was dealing with the Battle of Los Angeles and its aftermath, and our pilots in Europe were dealing with what were referred to as Foo Fighters. An American veteran of the Normandy invasion on D-Day recalled his service aboard a B-17 heavy bomber. That's one of 13,000 Allied warplanes operated against the European continent by the U.S. 8th Air Force before the landings got underway in the early morning hours of June 6, 1944. He said, our target was a railroad depot. I was the right side waist gunner looking inside of our formation before we left on our raid. About 10 minutes after we crossed the coast, that was about 1 o'clock in the morning, I heard one of our fighter pilot escorts over the radio call out, Bandit, 6 o'clock high and low. Now, after I heard this, I went to cock my weapon and it jammed. Tried my best to check the jam. It appeared normal but remained inoperative. Just as the distressed waist gunner saw the bandits that had been referred to by the fighter pilots, and they were swiftly approaching, but they resembled no fighter planes, which he was familiar. They were luminous spears that bore no national insignia, and their intentions were hardly less uncertain. One of the objects appeared in between our formation, and I went to get ready to shoot him. Its jamming coincided with the failure of electrical systems aboard the aircraft as the radios went dead and our number 4 engine stalled out. Unable to communicate and losing power, the defenseless flying fortress couldn't keep up with its formation and dropped out of place to become an easy target for enemy interceptors. As the mysteriously stricken B-17 gradually fell behind, the object sped off at an exceptionally high speed. 15 minutes later, the waist gunner's 50 caliber Browning inexplicably unjammed itself. Radio communication came back on. The previously dead Wright Cyclone engine sputtered back to life. Well, the crew had met with what became known as the Foo Fighter. Now, General Carl Spatz, U.S. Air Force Chief of Staff, referring to people who claimed to have seen these unidentified flying objects, said, I've also known men who've seen pink elephants. But I don't think you ever saw a pink elephant that could shut down the systems of an aircraft. But for too many of the airmen under General Spatz's command who experienced similar encounters, these confrontations were certainly no laughing matter. Foo Fighter was a pun on Foo, F-E-U, the French word for fire, as it derived from the then popular Smokey Stover comic strip. The comment is, where there's Foo, there's fire. Term is colloquially applied by United States Army Air Force flight crews to unknown metallic spears, discs, lights, boomerangs, cigar shapes, or fireballs that mostly escorted, sometimes buzzed, and occasionally threatened and infrequently skirmished with Allied airmen. Evidently, the D-Day heavy bomber had been singled out for an electromagnetic attack by the spherical intruder, which didn't disturb any of the other bombers in the formation. But its airmen were more fortunate than her comrades aboard another B-17 the previous year. During the September 6, 1943 mission to raid Stuttgart, 384th Group found itself proceeding between 2,000 and 3,000 feet beneath and a little behind five Luftwaffe aircraft. Before any engagement could occur, a cluster composed of small round objects, silver in color, simply fell out of the sky. That was according to the testimony of two different aircraft, American aircraft crews. As to its shape, it was a mass of material. It kept a good pattern, didn't dissipate as it streamed down and fell comparatively slowly. In one instance, the cluster appeared to be about 8 feet in length, about 4 feet wide as it streaked down. Another observation stated it was about 75 feet long and about 20 feet wide. The dimensions in length being the size from top to bottom as it fell. There was no connection between the mass of silver spheroids and the German interceptors. That much was clear. According to one of the testimonies, those enemy aircraft weren't seen to drop the material. It came from above our aircraft from a clear sky. In all instances, the objects fell in the path of our aircraft. Some was observed to fall on the wings of a B-17 belonging to our group, and that wing immediately started to burn, and the Flying Fortress fell to Earth like a comet. This aircraft did not return from the mission. Its 10 crew members were the first human fatalities in the 20th century War of the World. Lethal attacks by UFOs and Allied or Axis warplanes were rare. More typically, pilots and crews on both sides of the conflict were approached in flight by the Foo Fighters, which kept pace with the warplanes, often despite extreme evasive maneuvers, before vanishing away at high speeds. Such encounters are by no means dubious tales brought on by battle fatigue, fear, disorientation, altitude sickness, weather conditions, misidentification of conventional aircraft, or glimpses of enemy secret weapons. These presumed cases were more often used by Air Force brass to explain away rather than actually explain what their men were experiencing. Many hundreds reported remarkably similar experiences in all the combat theaters, the majority occurring in the last 2 years of the war. How many more Air Force witnesses never reported what they saw for fear of losing their flight privileges or even being classified as Section 8, which was military language for nutso, to say nothing of ridicule from their fellow flyers? That number can't be ascertained. While B-17 crews were encountering Foo Fighters over Europe, their communist allies 1,800 miles away in the east were seeing the same kind of inexplicable aircraft. July 4, 1943, just as the pivotal Battle of Kursk was about to commence, a huge silvery disk hovered over the opposing forces. It didn't intervene in the fighting, and it vanished after a few minutes. Soviet High Command feared the object was Hitler's much-vaunted secret weapon, according to Russian-born Paul Stonehill, who's an expert on Soviet affairs. Although no photographs of it survived, a drawing of the object was made, and several Soviet colonels who later took part in the battle signed that it was, in fact, what they had seen. On August 26, 3 days after the battle, Red Army Senior Lieutenant Gennady Zelaganov reported having seen a sickle-shaped craft fly at extraordinary speed, far faster than any Russian or German airplane, over an area of Kursk targeted by his artillery. Before it vanished into the southwest, he noticed that the boomerang-like vehicle was dark blue overall with a bright orange center section. More typical was a sighting made over Poland by Lev Petrovich Ovisker, the bombardier navigator of a Petoyakov PE-2 medium bomber. November 1944, he, the pilot, and the rear gunner watched an immense, excessively bright object pass slowly over a frontline Soviet airfield near Warsaw at about 1,600 feet on the ground. Red Army Lieutenant Colonel Kowalchuk observed that the 500-foot-long craft roughly resembled moving like a dirigible. Although it didn't make any sound, it lacked fins, outboard engines, propellers, gondolas, portholes, guy wires, insignia, or any external details of any kind. According to Stonehill, Air Defense Unit fired on it with cannons and machine guns, but it had no effect as a uniformly dark apparition gradually disappeared over the northern horizon. This encounter was authoritatively documented by retired Soviet Army Colonel German Kolchin in a 2000 issue of New Literary Observer, which is the oldest Russian independent magazine specializing in philology, cultural history, and historical anthropology. Like their British and American comrades, the Russians never gave a thought to extraterrestrial possibilities, but consistently referred to these craft as German disc. Kent Courtney shared their conclusions. While ferrying a transport plane from Brazil to Morocco in February 1943 at 10,000 feet over the South Atlantic, several lights flew at him head-on, narrowly avoiding a collision, and then turned back to buzz his aircraft before speeding away into the night. After landing safely in Casablanca, he made his report. "We're advised by the Army and the Air Force to keep it to ourselves," the former captain told Alexandria, Louisiana's Daily Town Talk. "The official view of the Air Force was to quell the investigation, stop it cold." Courtney talked with numerous World War II pilots who had seen UFOs and received the same orders from their superiors. "The boys were afraid to be grounded if they reported the lights, so they kept still about them." Harry Cowell, a U.S. Army Air Force fighter pilot stationed in France on November 8, 1944, recalled 3 years later for an interview with the Seattle Daily Times. But the following night, another crew saw the same thing and did report it. After that, all the crews in the squadron, with the exception of two, had the same experience with these mysterious aircraft. Night fighter crews in the squadron to which Cole was attached reported seeing the strange lights while filing over the Rhine Valley. So many sightings and their repeated commonalities constitute powerful proof of the reality of the phenomenon. Skeptics may deprecate the value of such observations, but they forget that eyewitness testimony, particularly if it's consistent and offered by people unknown to each other, is admissible in a court of law as corroborative evidence. Cowell went on to describe something more than a sighting his squadron experienced. The first crew to see him noticed that the light seemed to be flying right with the aircraft. It was a Northrop P-61 Black Widow night fighter. The boys didn't know what they were and tried an evasive action, but the light seemed to stay right with them. Finally, one of the boys decided to shoot at one of the lights to see what would happen, and he blasted away with four 20-millimeter Hispano cannons, plus another quartet of 50-caliber Browning machine guns firing from an upper turret. There was an explosion that rocked the plane and bent the plexiglass dome on it. In a somewhat similar confrontation that took place the night of, August 10th, 11th of that same year, on the other side of the world, but with different results. First Officer Russell Watson was piloting a B-29 Super Fortress, number 6362, on its return flight from a combined raid with the 20th Air Force on the Pletho oil refinery at Palembang in Sumatra. In his report to the 20th Bomber Command's Air Intelligence Section, he stated he and several bomber crews observed what they believed was a bizarre, confusing type of new weapon. One aircraft was under continuous attack for an hour and 10 minutes, beginning 10 minutes after leaving the target area. Reddish-orange balls about the size of baseballs suddenly appeared out of nowhere on the starboard beam. Momentary flash or trail about 6 inches long preceded the red ball effect, and this was followed immediately by an explosion. The balls appeared to break up into four or five fragments that flew in all directions and appeared in fours and threes and twos and singly, but never more than four together at the same time. This was usually about an interval of about 10 seconds between volleys. The crews estimated they observed a total of 250 to 300 separate bursts during the attack. The explosions were always off the right beam, never close in 400 yards, never further away than 700 yards, and always accurate as to altitude. Aircraft was flying at 16,000 feet over an undercast that was at 10,000 feet, varying from 5/10 to 10/10 of a mile. Lateral visibility was estimated at 30 miles, except for an occasional scattered clouds, but no enemy aircraft were ever sighted. There was no ground flashes observed when the ground was visible. Bursts weren't observed when the aircraft flew through clouds, but reappeared when the clouds were passed. On one occasion, the course was altered sufficiently to allow tail guns to bear in the direction of the burst, but 20-millimeter and 50-caliber fire from the B-29 had absolutely no visible effect on these flying objects. B-29 wasn't damaged in spite of all the explosions. Now, this wasn't the only occurrence of alien pursuit in the Pacific Theater. Oh, no. November 3rd, 1944, North American Mitchell B-25 medium bombers flew under their 10th Air Force Base in Burma to raid targets in Japanese-occupied China. While attacking bridge approaches at the Xinhui, Namkoi, and Quanggai, the B-25s were set up on by an undetermined number of glittering objects that buzzed and circled all nine aircraft, which experienced complete instrument failure and progressive loss of power to the engines. Foo fighters maneuvered so erratically at such high speeds the gunners weren't able to track them, much less get off a shot at them. Only after the objects broke off the action were the bombers' electrical systems and full engine RPMs restored. Some of the most compelling armed force encounters with off-world craft during the Pacific campaign were experienced by officers and men aboard vessels in the U.S. Navy. An extraordinary instance occurred early in the conflict as an invasion fleet assembled among the Solomon Islands east of Papua New Guinea for America's first counteroffensive of the war. Scheduled to begin on August 7th, 1942, 2 days before at 10 in the morning, as the men aboard the USS Helm were readying their destroyer for Operation Watchtower, lookout sounded the alert to an unidentified aircraft rapidly approaching between 3,000 and 4,000 feet in the clear cloudless sky. This craft was spotted through a pair of 750-power field binoculars by a security detail observer who determined that the 90-foot-wide bogey was silverly cigar-shaped and topped with a round dome. Now, for those that are not familiar with the language, a bogey was a term commonly used for UFOs and military reports. Both the captain and the executive officer had a good look at this thing, according to Keith Chester, and they confirmed it had the appearance of a streamlined cigar with portholes around the dome. When it approached within 3,000 yards, the Helm's anti-aircraft gunners commenced firing. Their fire had no effect. When three nearby cruisers and seven destroyers joined in the shooting, the object executed a sharp turn, increased its speed, and proceeded to circle once around the entire fleet. With this, every gun in the task force opened up on the object. One veteran of that encounter recalled that directional control released all guns and said for the gun captains to go local control. That's free fire, don't you know? Although the fire control director could keep up with him, the bogey, the gunners weren't able to take enough lead out of their machines to allow them to swing far enough ahead to hit the thing. So they just swung wild and started throwing shells in and firing with the 50s, whatever else available to try and get at least one hit. With so many explosions near, we couldn't tell where we were shooting or anybody else. So there was no way really of getting a crack at this thing. The director of control insisted that the lone intruder had reached speeds of 1,000 miles an hour. Far beyond anything we had available at the time. The craft passed undamaged through the massive concentration of firepower spewed skyward by the whole invasion armada, then vanished in an incredible display of speed. Because of its thousands of eyewitness participants, the August 5th, 1942 incident was maybe the best attested UFO sighting in World War II. When an entire task force failed, carrier planes of the USS Wasp fared no better. During the early afternoon of February 7, 1945, while the warship cruised off the Ulithi Atoll of Ulitha in the Caroline Islands, Commander Norman Stark was informed of a rapidly incoming radar contact at 30,000 feet, some 10 miles out. He immediately launched five Grumman F-6F Hellcats, but the fighter's top speed of 391 miles per hour was just simply inadequate to intercept the supersonic bogey. Another similar event occurred at Ulithi 4 months later. Lookouts aboard the SS Calvin Victory, cruising 16 knots on a westerly course from Iniwetok, an atoll in the Marshall Islands, pointed out a silver object directly overhead at about 2 p.m. On the bridge at the time was Captain Wesley Brown, Jr., who, after observing through 50x7 binoculars that the contact was bright silver, circular in shape, ordered the freighter's bow-mounted 50-caliber machine gun and 8 20-millimeter cannons to open fire. Now, this time, gun crews had visually sighted on the target at an estimated altitude of 4,000 feet. And although that craft held position directly above the vessel and took no evasive action, the crew fired 8 to 10 shots with no observable impact. Because of the ineffectiveness of his gunners, as well as the object's apparent lack of interest in carrying out an attack, Brown commanded them to cease fire. Meanwhile, as recorded in the ship's log, the craft kept pace high above the Calvin Victory for the remainder of the afternoon. Disappeared only when nightfall came. After the war, Brown became the head of the Police Science and Administration Department at Northern Arizona University and wrote of his South Pacific encounter to the renowned ufologist J. Allen Hynek in 1974. The first documented sightings of USOs, unidentified submersible objects, was made by American service personnel during World War II. During the night of October 12, 1943, Seaman Matthew Mangle was keeping watch aboard a U.S. Navy supply vessel in the Persian Gulf when he observed a huge disc beneath the surface of the water glowing with a soft green light. He said it was pacing the ship at 12 knots before speeding up and moving out of sight. From January 26th to 31st, 1945, as the USS McCracken cruised between the Solomon Islands, Lewis Gracie and four other sailors watched as their troop ship was almost passed directly over a submerged round object lying still at a shallow depth. Sharply outlined, it was the size of a gun turret, about 20 feet across with a dull silvery finish. Gracie and his mates refrained from reporting their sightings at the time, dismissing it as simply a monster sea turtle. Second World War's outstanding USO experience took place in mid-1945. U.S. Army attack transport ship was wallowing through 10-degree rolls amid heavy seas and strong winds in the open ocean past the Aleutian Island of Etik on a return voyage to Seattle. The overburdened USS Delaroff had been hauling munitions and supplies during early summer from Washington State to Alaska. Near dusk on this date, one early summer evening, several crewmen yelled out suddenly at the sight of a strange, large vehicle shooting into the air from underwater. Private Robert Crawford was in on the port side near the communications room where he's one of the radio operators. That's when he heard the commotion. He saw a large, peculiar vessel ascending roughly vertically upward, 1/4 to 2 miles away in the west. It stood out dark and round against the setting sun, rising to an angular elevation of 5 degrees before arcing to a level circular path. Crawford could clearly see the featureless disc without insignia or portholes was 150 to 200 feet in diameter as it silently circled the transport at about the speed of a small airplane, maybe 100 miles an hour, if that, no more than 500 feet above the rough sea. No speed and altitude afforded a clear view of the craft as it flew in a leisurely circular pattern overhead, presenting itself an easy target for the ship's gunners. Although they were ready to pull triggers at the mere suggestion of attack, they held their fire and they also held their breath. Completing a third leisurely circuit of the Delaroff, the object departed toward the south-southwest. Following its appearance and disappearance in that direction after sundown, some crew members saw three flashes of light from the area where it had vanished. Back in Seattle, 14 of them signed a written statement affirming the accuracy of their observations. Among the eyewitnesses, Robert Crawford went on to become a consulting geologist with the Indiana Soil Testing Laboratory in Griffin, Indiana. While a graduate student at the University of North Dakota, he shared his wartime sighting with his teacher, geology professor N.N. Kolanowski, who was then a science advisor to the National Investigative Committee on Aerial Phenomena.
Okay, maybe the most disturbing account of its kind was discussed 5 years after the war by Edward Ludwig. During the last week of June 1944, his executive officer, a small Coast Guard manned cargo vessel approaching the tiny island of Palmyra. That's about 800 miles southeast of Hawaii. He said they got a radio message appealing for his assistance and searching for a Navy patrol plane believed lost at sea. Despite prolonged and extensive scouting of the area by Ludwig's ship and company with dozens of other rescue vessels and aircraft, they didn't find anything. Not even a scrap of floating debris or spot of oil to indicate the plane had crashed.
Now, he said this was highly unusual because aircraft downed at sea invariably scattered the surface with abundant wreckage. 24 hours later, he was on watch on the bridge of his ship when a bright light suddenly appeared in the nighttime sky. He reported as soon as he saw the object in the sky that it was neither plane nor star, definitely round, a spear, hovering over the ship, motionless, silent, at least five times as bright as the most brilliant star. Then it began to move with almost imperceptible slowness, and finally it stopped. For a half hour, it continued its slow, purposeful maneuvers until it had covered an area of about 90 degrees. Last, it headed northwards, away from the island, in the direction where the plane had been lost. Now, he made official inquiries about that lighted spear, wondering to himself if the two incidents, the spear and the lost plane, might somehow be related. The Navy lieutenant in charge told him absolutely no aircraft had been aloft that night, and no Japanese could possibly be within 1,000 miles. And he was puzzled by the problem of the missing plane. His radio direction finder, he believed, had somehow malfunctioned, resulting in a reversal of directions. But, of course, this theory couldn't explain why two experienced pilots familiar with the area would fly directly into the setting sun away from the island instead of the correct direction. And in the Navy lieutenant's parting words, I think, were quite interesting. He said, maybe the inhabitants of that strange spear wanted specimens. You never can tell. You know, Wernher von Braun, who was Hitler's head of his nuclear program, who later became head of NASA, said, with 100 billion stars in our galaxy alone, what would make us think we're the only life form? And certainly, I agree with him. You know, while there's been a lot of talk about the Foo Fighters and allied encounters with strange aircraft, you know, the Nazis had their own issues. You know, Wernher von Braun's question was actually answered definitively February 3rd, 1942, when aviatrix Hanna Reiss, Germany's famous female test pilot, took off in the world's first operational rocket-powered fighter plane. Now, it was still experimental, but the Messerschmitt 163A V4 Comet was climbing at 525 feet per second at 7.5 miles above the Earth. It went almost straight up into the sky. But as it flew, a silverly luminous disk shot past her as though the comet was standing still. It went to 60,000 feet, 2,600 feet higher than the Messerschmitt's maximum ceiling. The object that had no insignia vanished almost as quickly as it had appeared. Maybe somebody on board that strange craft wanted to show that even mankind's latest aircraft couldn't keep up with what these mysterious pilots had available to them. Well, we're going to talk more in our next show about close encounters of the Axis kind. But until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.